We are in Genesis 13, the passage that Melissa read for us just a few minutes ago, looking at just a few weeks of the life of a man by the name of Lot, who to this point in the story shows up just kind of in a funny little phrase. It's like, it's Abraham's story. And then the little phrase is, and Lot went with him. He just kind of is there tagging along. And to today, kind of where the story goes, the spotlight for a brief moment becomes much more focused in his direction, not necessarily in a positive way, but in important ways. And so we're going to work through that in chapter 13 and 14. Just a quick reminder kind of how the story unfolds. God calls Abraham out of a place called Ur. Abraham follows, bringing some of his family with him as he travels to the promised land. The odd part of the story is that as he comes to the promised land, it doesn't seem particularly great in the sense that he arrives and just all his wildest dreams come true. Every once in a while, I've joked with my family. It's like my dream is one day to live in Disney on Main Street. Main Street, Disney. But I don't want anyone else there. That would actually ruin it. I don't like crowds. But if I could just have the whole thing, it's like, oh, and there'd be fireworks every night just before I go to bed. It would just be awesome. The promised land in Abraham's spirit experience is not like that. He goes, and the first thing he encounters is a famine, which I don't know kind of how that feels to you. It's like if you set off to follow the Lord, it's like, leave your home, follow me, I'll show you the way. It's like probably kind of what you expect next is like, well, whatever comes next is awesome. And it is in the sense that it's going to be an incredible test to help Abraham come to the point of understanding how he can trust God, but not maybe awesome in the sense that it's just full of prosperity and goodness. In fact, it's a story of scarcity. And we tend to think of like, well, probably scarcity is a bit of a test. We don't tend to think that prosperity is, but that's kind of where the story goes next, because Abram at that point leaves the promised land, sort of forgetting seemingly God, flees to Egypt to find food and find ways to sort of survive, makes a whole bunch of sinful, terrible decisions. Despite all that, he is still growing in prosperity. He eventually returns to the promised land, and that's where chapter 13 picks up. As he went from Egypt, he and his wife and all he had, and Lot with him. There he is again. He's still there. And the story goes on. It actually tells us in verse 2 that he comes out of Egypt very rich. And actually, the actual description is heavy in riches, which I think is actually a very interesting way to put it. You could actually fairly translate it, burdened in riches. So many of us think, if I could just get there, whatever there is, whatever that line in the bank account, we're like, man, when I hit that line, everything is going to be, don't we think of it as like light and free and carefree? And then you read the story, it's like, hold on a second. That is a very different description. In fact, Matthew Henry, who the commentator many years back, he writes this, of this very scene. He says, Abraham is very heavy. Riches are a burden. The burden in getting wealth, the fear in keeping wealth, the temptation in using wealth, the guilt in abusing wealth, the sorrow in losing wealth, and the burden of giving an account on that great day for the wealth that we had. The story is not about stuff and all those kind of things. It's just one of those just brief moments in the middle of a story where it's like, hold on a second, Don. Make sure your heart gets recalibrated. That can't be the goal. That brings a burden. In fact, the New Testament goes on and it's like, instruct those who are wealthy in the things of this world to not trust their stuff, but to trust God. And you might be going, well, okay, the wealthy need to hear that. Do you know that probably, if you think historically, I was thinking just the other day, I was thinking as I was sitting in my hot tub, that, you know, if you read much history and you read of, you know, the emperors of the past and the kings, not that long ago, like maybe even just 100 years ago, the level of comfort you have in your life was stuff they could never even dream of. Like a dry, comfortable bed at night, tap that you turn on, hot water just comes out, like an oven in your kitchen where just food can get heated up like that quick. It's like, these are luxuries that not that long ago people couldn't even imagine. You live better than most of the greatest kings and emperors and queens to have ever lived on this planet. Which reminds me that we ought to then take that instruction to heart and not just go, oh, that's for someone else. Someone else needs to be reminded not to trust in the things of this world, but to trust in God. It's like, no, I need to be reminded not to trust in those things. Abraham comes out carrying that weight and Lot with him. Because you notice in the story, it's not just Abraham who has prospered in that sense. So has Lot. But Abraham comes back at that beginning point to worship God. You see him go almost sort of through the steps of kind of like returning actually physically to the place where he had encountered God. He comes through the Negev as far as Bethel, between Bethel and Ai, these two towns or two places where he had made an altar at first. And I just love that. Just love the way of speaking of it, because it just reminds me, like, we need to just constantly be recalibrating our hearts. And it might not be go back to a physical place. Hopefully, in part of gathering as a church on a Sunday, it's a little bit of that, right? It's just like just the constant recalibration of our hearts. The week kind of like can kick us, can distract us, can discourage us. And then we hopefully come together as God's people and worship him and go, okay, reset. It's more than just a throwaway comment. I think it's actually important. At that time, the Canaanites and Perizzites were dwelling in the land. So that sheds a whole nother piece on it, because this is the land that God brought them to that was going to be theirs. And now we find out there's actually an impending problem that one day will have to be faced. The land is occupied. There are people there. That's a problem in some ways, sort of a tomorrow problem in Genesis, but it's recognition that there is a problem coming. But it also sheds a light on this situation, because as Lot and Abram, the two who have walked with God to some degree, are going to carry out this conflict. Don't you get the sense? It's like there are people watching. And if you go all the way back to Genesis, when God first comes to Abram, he says, Abram, I'm going to bless you, and I'm going to lead you, and I'm going to provide for you so that, remember the so that you will be a blessing to the nations. In other words, so that as people watch you, they are going to understand who I am. Your lives are going to be kind of the display case for my character, my purposes, and my glory. And really, in the first time in Abraham's journey where he's going to get to display this, it just is going to go horribly, sadly wrong. And again, I don't think that's the main part of the story, but it's just, again, one of those moments of just remembering. It's like how we live out our faith. It actually matters. People are watching, and you might not even be aware of it. You might not be aware who's watching or when they are watching. But we are to do what Abraham was to do, which is to live out our life of faith, enjoying the blessing of God, and he does bless, so that the nations would see and understand who our God is. So that sets the scene for this strange little conflict that we read about of too much prosperity and not enough space to live it out. Verse 9, we have Abram speaking to Lot. And here's what he says. Is not the whole land before you? Separate yourself from me. If you take the left hand, I will go right. If you take the right hand, I will go left. Now, that is probably the backwards version of what I would have expected. Abram is his uncle. Abraham is the patriarch. And I know he calls him a kinsman, which kind of, it's just a sign of Abram's humility. They are not even. Lot is the younger man, and it should have gone down like this. Lot, I will pick the best part. I'll take what's first. The leftovers are all yours. That's how it should have gone. And so I hope you see how shocking it is of what Abram's doing in this situation where he's saying, you pick first, you take whatever you want, and I will take the leftovers. Hebrews looks back at Abram and says he is a man of faith who lives not by what he sees. He's not walking by sight, he's walking by faith, walking by trust in the Lord. That is in part, I think, the lesson of what's going to happen in these next few verses. And Lot lives the other way. In fact, you see it in the very next verse. Look at verse 10. And Lot lifted up his eyes. The basis of his decision will be not just a matter of faith, it's going to be a matter of sight for Lot. Now, I think this is important. Imagine for a second you invited me over to your house and said, you know what, I made a special cake. And it was one of those cakes, you know, with the flour icing all around. Now, I like icing, so maybe you don't, so maybe this analogy won't work at all, but it's got the icing, and you know in that situation, you want the corner piece. I mean, who doesn't, really? That's the got prime, like, your maximum icing is that. Now, imagine you had me over and said, hey, just, you know, cut whatever piece of the cake you want. And I grabbed the knife and started cutting all the outside, like all the edges, all the corners, and like scoop it all up, put it on my plate, and leave me, you know, like that middle part where there sort of like wasn't enough icing at the end, and there's like just barely a layer, and then it's just dry cake underneath. I'm like, here, you can have this. That's kind of the situation. It's way more shocking like that. Way more. I mean, you would go, well, that's kind of inappropriate. You wouldn't. Social etiquette probably ought not to do that. A tip for you if you're ever in a situation, don't do that. But this is even more shocking of what we're about to see here. The patriarch, the head of the family, about to give up what is best. And the answer of Lot, here's how I wish Lot had responded. But even before I say it, it's like, I bet you if I was in the same spot, I don't know that I would have. But don't you wish Lot would have said, hold everything. First of all, you are the one who leads this family. If anyone's picking first and picking best, that ought to be you. Second of all, you have been walking with God and he called you. And all the blessing we've enjoyed, it's because of the unique relationship you've had with God and his care. Do you think at this point I have any interest in being separated from that? Almost kind of like, you know, that Ruth and Naomi moment, if you know the story of Ruth and Naomi, where they go off into Moab and eventually Naomi's two sons marry two women, and then both sons die, and now there's Naomi and these two daughter-in-laws, and Naomi's going to go back to Israel, but she says to them, it's like, there is nothing for you there. Why don't you just stay? And the one daughter-in-law does. And then there's that great moment where Ruth says to Naomi, it's like, I'm not going to leave you. Your people will be my people and your God will be my God. And it's not going to be about which is the better place to do this. It's like, I am not going to leave the blessing of walking in fellowship with God. That's what I wish the story was with Lot, of just like, I would never make that trade. But he lifted up his eyes, and he saw that the Jordan Valley was well-watered everywhere, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt. It's like Egypt. He left Egypt. He came home from Egypt, but it's like Egypt didn't leave his heart. Now, at this point in the story, I want to propose to you that we're going to learn some things about how Lot makes this decision. Four things in particular. But before we dive into them, and we're doing good for time here this morning. This is good. We're catching up to last week. We're going to be ready to finish the story next week. Let me just qualify what I'm about to say next with one very important thing. Whenever you come to Scripture, one of the important first questions to ask yourself is, what did this mean to the people who first read it? It's a helpful question to ask yourself because then it helps when it comes to the next question of like, what does this mean for me? It just helps make sure we're reading it through the right set of lenses, because it's important to know what did it mean in its original setting and context. And I think if we think of this passage, it's very interesting. By the end of Deuteronomy, as the nation of Israel has just come out of slavery, interestingly enough, in Egypt, and they brought with them all the treasures of Egypt, and they've gone through the wilderness for 40 years and are basically standing at the Jordan River about to enter this same land, and then they will cross the river and they will walk through this land and they will divide the whole land up. You're like, hold on a second. It is amazingly like this moment in Genesis chapter 13. They've come out of Egypt. They've prospered. They're entering the land. They're at this point of dividing up the land. How might they have felt or thought as Moses, for the very first time, read them this story, the account of what happened with Abraham and his nephew Lot? And I think there would have been a number of lessons, more than I'm going to share with you. But one, and probably the big E on the eye chart, is think of the faithfulness of God. He's been with us right from the start. And even though we have constantly drifted from him, he's just graciously there, always faithful to his promises and bringing us back. And as we're about to cross this river, we can trust him. I can't help but think that's how you would have to feel when you read this story of like, look at the greatness of God on display. And that is an important beginning point, because sometimes when we read these stories, it's very easy to moralize them. Like, what I mean by that is turn them into very good, helpful, practical examples and warning of how to live life. We do it all the time. And it's not wrong. It's just that it should be the second thing we do. The first thing is, what do we learn about God? Second is, how do we then learn about how to walk a life of faith following God? It's just usually we miss that first part. And I think through this whole story, the first part is like, look at the faithfulness of God. Look at the commitment he has made to his promises, that even though everyone is failing left, right, and center, he will not abandon the promises he's made. We need to know that. We need just to be reminded over and over again, he's faithful. He's trustworthy. What he says, he will do, he will accomplish. However, there is that moral part to it as well. There is something to be learned. I think I've talked about it before, that, you know, the story of Daniel. Just as a comparison for a second, you can read the story of Daniel and go, remember, if you went to Sunday school, there was this little song, Dare to be a Daniel, Dare to Stand Alone. If you didn't, it's like, you have no idea what I'm talking about. But it's a great Bible story of this guy named Daniel who has, he does have tremendous courage. There's no doubt about it. But the story of Daniel is not like, read it and then dare to be a Daniel. The story of Daniel is, read it and be amazed at the God that Daniel follows, who controls the whole world. Like, you read, you get through that book and it's like, God is spectacular. Think of what he accomplishes. Like, it's amazing how he protects Daniel, how he directs the course of history. The main thing is about God. The second issue is about Daniel. Now back to Abraham's story. The main issue is what we learn about God. The second issue is we're going to learn something very important about how to walk through life. Some warnings, some instructions, some examples. Here we go. Number one is this. Lot's decision is guided by sight, not by promise. What I mean by that is Abraham is looking through the lens of the promises of God. Lot lifts up his eyes, goes, that's the nice part right over there. It's green, it's lush. My cattle and livestock will flourish. Last week, I mentioned just briefly that great verse from Proverbs 3, 5, and 6. I know it's precious to most of us, if you've ever considered it. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. And lean on your own understanding, right? What does it look like to lean on your own understanding? I think it looks like kind of like this moment in Lot's life, where he looks, he thinks, he listens, he absorbs information through his senses, and he takes the best of his experience and knowledge and does what he thinks is wise. Because there's no evidence in the story that he looks out over the land and is like, I want to sin. I want to rebel against God. He's just like, you might even be able to say, it's like, Lot has phenomenal stewardship at this point in the story. But it's all through his own understanding. None of it is coming through trust in the Lord. I wonder what would have happened had Lot said, you want to know what? It seems like the decision before me is a decision about a problem we have, because we have a scarcity of land and too much prosperity. And so we're trying to think through the decision from that angle. How do we solve this problem? What would have happened if Lot had taken one step back and said, before I answer that problem, I just want to remember the purpose why I'm here. Now, Lot wouldn't have known the Westminster Catechism. Fair enough. But he probably would have been able to have some sense of the reason we are here is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. And then I wondered to myself, if Lot had looked at the problem through those lenses, would he have made a different decision? He's looking, going, here's my flocks, my herds. I want them to prosper. What's the fastest route to prosperity? That brings you a very different answer than, I want to glorify God and I want to enjoy him. Because the answer to that would have surely been, I don't care about my flocks and herds and how green the grass is over there. I don't want to move away from my family and from relationship to Abram and the knowledge that God has made an amazing promise to Abram that I don't want to be any farther from than I have to be. And maybe there'll come a day where you need to wrestle through a problem like that. I'm not aware that many of us are beef farmers in our church. Maybe. You could let me know afterwards. But we all have our cattle, so to speak, right? Like that thing that we look at and it's like, if I just got to this level, then I will be, that would be great. And so we pursue the things that would take us to that, perhaps inadvertently, not even realizing that in making the decisions that way, we are going to move away from our ability to glorify God and enjoy him forever. That seems plain in the decision that Lot's making. He looks up, he considers things, he decides he's going to take this good land. So verse 11 tells us, Lot chose for himself all the Jordan Valley, and Lot journeyed east, thus separating each other. Thus they separated from each other. Abraham settled in the land of Canaan, which is interesting, is it not? Because that's the promised land. It's a very fascinating. So again, back to this decision point for just a second. God has brought them to the promised land, said, this is the land I promised you. This is where home is to be. Lot looks out and it's like, I will take the very outskirts of the land that's been promised and maybe even a little bit beyond. Like if you could stand at the spot Abraham and Lot were, some of you have been to Israel, so you can kind of almost picture this. You're kind of on the south end, probably maybe up in the En Gedi area, you're looking out, and it's not a particularly hospitable area. That's, if you've ever thought of it, or have ever been or seen pictures of it, you're thinking like the promised land, it must be gorgeous. It's like, it's a little surprising. I told the first service, the one moment that stands out for me the most is we were in the north part, and the guide who was with us was talking about how beautiful the Galilee is, and it's just like, it's the breadbasket of the nation, and it's so beautiful, and we're driving along, I'm like expecting, it's like, this is going to be amazing when I lay eyes on this beautiful breadbasket of the nation. And you're kind of coming through these hillsides and kind of waiting. It's like, I wonder when we're going to get there. And then you look at the guy and you realize it's like, the way he is looking, you know that look in your eye of just like, we've arrived. It's like, oh, shoot, this is it. And honestly, the exact thought that went through my head in that moment is like, if this was Canada, we wouldn't even bother with that. It's just scrubland. We might graze some cattle on it. That, you start to kind of get the pieces in your mind of like, there's Lot looking out. He's like, one area that looks prosperous, but it's right at the edge and over the edge of the land that God has promised us. And there's where he goes. Don't step out of the areas where God has promised to bless you. It's interesting because it doesn't seem to me that he's running from God. He's just managing his life without him. And that's part of the tragedy of the whole story. It's not that Lot commits one massive sin that just undoes his life. It's just a little step and a little step and a little step and a little step. It's not that Lot seems to want to rebel against God. It's just he doesn't factor him in. You see, if we go about only consulting God when the answer seems unclear, we haven't actually made God our Lord. He's just our backup plan. And yet it's so easy to do that, isn't it? To lean on my own understanding most of the time. And then I come to a point, I'm like, man, this is a hard decision. Now I want to know, God, what's your will? That's not making God my Lord. That's just, God's my backup plan when I'm stuck. Proverbs 3 says, I am to trust in the Lord with all my heart and lean not on my own understanding in all my ways. That's the hard part. Proverbs 3 is a wonderful statement, but don't confuse yourselves in thinking that it's an easy thing. It's a weighty thing. Lot makes his decision, and he has begun his path away from God. Now, we are going to run out of time. Man, we'll just do that. Second thing, Lot's direction. So he makes this decision, and then we're told in just very brief detail some of the direction this decision takes him. Just jump ahead to verse 12. Abram settled in the land of Canaan, while Lot settled among the cities of the valley. And he moved his tent as far as Sodom. Actually, I think one of the translations says he pitched his tent towards Sodom. That's an interesting statement, isn't it? It's like, I'm not going to go quite that far, but man, I'm not opposed to being a little bit close to that. It's almost like, as you read it, it's like him knowing, it's like, I probably ought not to do that, but close. I'm not there, but I'll stay outside, but just kind of in the neighborhood of that over there. Have you ever had one of those campfires where the fire gets really hot and you're wearing jeans? I don't know if I'm the only one who's had this experience. I'm probably not. And you stand there and you're enjoying the heat, and then all of a sudden you move and your jeans touch your leg, and it's like, oh my goodness, this is a problem. And then you typically turn around and you just kind of repeat, because we're not super smart when it comes to that. Some of you, I see you smoke. Yeah. You do exactly what I do. And it's like the whole time, it's like, ouch, this is getting really uncomfortable. It's kind of like that. He's moved close enough that he doesn't even realize what's about to happen in his life, because the story doesn't get better. As he pitches, it's like he pitches his tent. It's like his heart is kind of attached to that whole thing. It's not just a matter of pitching his tent. It's like he's turned his heart towards Sodom. And again, it's not like he's out there and saying, forget God, I'm all in on Sodom. It's just a little slight adjustment. Meanwhile, what's Abraham doing? Well, 14 to the end of the chapter tells us God comes to him, reaffirms the promise, and what does Abraham do at the end? He goes to Hebron, and there he builds an altar to the Lord. And you couldn't have two greater contrasts. One man, worshiping God, concerned about building an altar to worship him. The other, it's like, how close can I get my tent to Sodom before the pain from the fire starts to make it uncomfortable? Be careful where your decisions lead you. They just one little one after another. Third, the consequence. Remember I said last week, you are free to make decisions. You're just not free from the consequence of them. Lot makes some decisions. In fact, by the time you get to chapter 14, jump ahead for a moment with me to chapter 14, verse 12. The beginning part of chapter 14, just in a nutshell, is a list of all the kings around Sodom and Gomorrah, all these cities, and then there's a giant war that breaks out between all these kingdoms, and it's chaos, it's a horrific scene, and they're fighting all in this area, and, well, let me back to verse 11, I'll give you a picture. So the enemy took possession of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their provisions and went their way. They also took Lot, the son of Abram's brother, who was dwelling in Sodom, and his possessions, and went their way. You notice that just that little, we're never told, like, what was the day when Lot went from pitching his tent towards Sodom to just like, you know what, who are we kidding anymore? Let's just move in. But it happens somewhere between chapter 13 and 14. In 14, he moves one step away from Abram, pitches his tent that direction. And by chapter 14, he is among the people of Sodom who will lose everything. Sin has this funny way about it, that it holds out this allure of freedom and comfort. And then the very thing that it holds out as the promise of freedom and comfort becomes the very thing that enslaves us. It doesn't bring comfort, it brings capture to us. I recognize I'm reading a little bit between the lines on this story because we're not told the details, but it certainly seems somewhere in there, this slow slide progression that didn't begin with rebellion in Lot's heart. It just began kind of with a redefinition around the edges. Leads him by the end into a spot I don't think he ever imagined he would be. If you're somewhere in that journey, it's like, man, turn back to God. Just go, you know what? I've started to drift. I am coming back to God before I end up moving another step further. Last, and certainly not least, and probably the pinnacle part of the story to this point in chapter 14. Lot is now captured. He is now enslaved as a prisoner of war. And then this, verse 13 of chapter 14. The one who had escaped came and told Abram the Hebrew, who was living by the oaks of Mamre, the Amorite, the brother of Eshcol and Aner. These were allies of Abram. And when Abram heard that his kinsmen had been taken captive, he led forth his trained man born in his house, 318 of them, and went in pursuit as far as Dan. And if you read to the end of the story, Abram rescues Lot. There's no hesitation. Abram hears, he goes. It's just a pile of conviction. And as you read through the story, you realize, like, this man is going to risk his life. He's going to risk his prosperity. He's going to take 318 of his men to go to war to save the man who had just compromised everything. That's an interesting conclusion. Actually, again, if you ever get to Israel, make sure you go to Dan. The gate Abraham would have walked through is actually there. It's my favorite spot. It's amazing. 4,000-year-old gate made out of mud. It's like, man, that's an aside. I'm not sure about traveling to Israel right at the moment. So if you're like super enthusiastic, the pastor said go and see it, and like maybe just wait just a little bit. But it's just amazing to see these real places. These are real things that happen. Abraham really did risk a tremendous amount to save a man whose life was just full of compromise and mess. And when I think on that, here's where my thoughts go next. Jesus did infinitely more. What Philippians 2 tells me is that Jesus gave up immense glory and honor. He set all that aside to come and save sinners, enemies who were fully rebellious against him. And he didn't just risk his life in the sense that he wasn't sure. It's like he laid down his life for you. Isn't that amazing? When you think of it, you think of what Abraham did, this man who was faithful and full of faith, and he saved Lot. Then there is the Son of Man, the Savior of the world, who gives his life for you. I love how that story ends at this point. Here's the part I don't love of Abraham's story. Not Abraham, but Lot. Lot's rescued. And here's how we wish the story goes. Here's how I wish the story goes at this point. Lot is rescued by Abraham, and he says to Abraham, I can't believe the path I chose. I see clearly now as I look back, my compromise led to another compromise, and I got near Sodom, I got in Sodom, and I will never go back to Sodom. Except the story will not be like that at all. Next week, when we'll pick up Lot's story again, he's right back where he began. And here's my hope and a prayer for me and for you, that when Jesus sets us free, we will not go back to our version of Sodom, to our place that we think, well, maybe there's prosperity, maybe there's comfort. Instead, we will say, I've found the King of Kings and I will never turn from him. Costly? I guess. Jesus says, count the cost. Don't be foolish in following him. Can you imagine if I came today and said, you want to know what? If you pay me $1 today, I will give you $1,000 every day for the rest of your life. You'd go, well, that sounds like a scam. Like, that might be the only hesitation. Maybe. And you'd be right. I can't actually do that for you. But do you know the offer of Christ is infinitely better? Like, we are talking about eternity and forgiveness and adoption into his son. He says,